Welcome back to Explore Cell Therapy, where hematology, oncology, and transplant experts examine practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies. I'm your host, Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Rachel Sallett of Fred Hutch Cancer Center and Katie Scheppner of NMDP Be the Match, both members of the American Society for Transplantation and Cellular Therapy, or ASTCT, Return to Work Guidance Committee. Together, we explore the guidance document published for healthcare providers to support their patients in returning to work after transplantation. We examine the challenges of returning to work after transplant, the literature that informs this new guidance document, and the importance of early and consistent coordination and communication before, during, and after transplant. To read bios on the session moderator and panelists, and to access additional resources related to this panel discussion, click the link in the episode description. This is part one of a two-part episode. So I am here today with Dr. Rachel Sallett and Katie Scheppner. It's a pleasure to host you both today. Thank you for joining me on Explore Cell Therapy.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. So today we're discussing recently released recommendations for healthcare providers to facilitate patients' plans to return to work after hematopoietic stem cell transplant. It's an important topic in post-transplant quality of life for many patients that unfortunately can be difficult to achieve. So as a transplant physician and a licensed social worker, I understand that you both worked closely on a committee of experts in post-transplant care, survivorship, rehabilitation, social work, and psychology under the American Society for Transplantation and Cellular Therapy, ASTCT, to publish this evidence-based review and recommendations. So I was hoping we could start off with, you know, just talking a little bit about how that got started and what your major goals were.
Well, I think my experience has been working for the last 11 years at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in our long-term follow-up clinic, and realizing how many patients were not returning to work even years after their stem cell transplant. Many of them were still on disability. They didn't know where to begin. And a lot of them were young patients, even in their 20s or 30s, who never even got a start. And so I thought, you know, where can we begin to look at what these issues are? And I was encouraged by Karen Seralia, who's a biobehavioral psychologist who's now retired, to survey transplant providers, both in the U.S. and internationally, to see what kind of guidance or guidelines they had for their transplant patients in terms of returning to work. And what we found from that survey is that there was very little out there, that most of the centers were advising patients to stay out of work for about a year after transplant, and that any guidance they gave them was really minimal. So even at our own center, our guidance was really a one slide on PowerPoint saying, you know, nurses or educators who are working with people should stay out of work for at least a year so they don't have infectious exposures. If you're on immune suppression, you should also, you know, be staying out of work until you're off immune suppression. And so we compiled this into an initial manuscript. And then the thought was, well, how do we change this? Part of the survey was asking these transplant center directors, you know, if they thought return to work was a problem, and then, you know, if they thought patients would benefit from some type of guidance or guidelines. And their response almost uniformly was yes, you know, whatever you can provide. And so I essentially gathered this group of leaders, and Katie was recommended to me by Linda Burns, who I had worked with on that survey, as a very strong advocate for this, these patients, and a formal social worker for University of Minnesota, and someone who would be able to be an excellent resource for developing these kind of guidelines. And I think our major goal with developing the guidelines was to dispel some of these myths that there isn't a lot of data to support in terms of timelines for people to stay out of work, and that they need to stay out of work till they're off immune suppression. We also, when I was gathering this committee, you know, the advice from Karen again was, you know, in addition for social work and physical therapy and occupational therapy, we needed an infectious disease expert. You know, and because many of the guidance is really based on transplant providers thinking these patients are at risk for infections going back to work, which they are. But there is not a lot of data as confirmed by the infectious disease specialist, even in the solid tumor transplant literature, where these patients are on immune suppression for the rest of their lives, that they can never return to work on immune suppression. And so, that was the main goal of these, you know, forming this committee. And then if I may say one more thing, I had also on the original transplant providers survey, I had come across an occupational therapist named Chiara DiBiase. And she worked for the Anthony Nolan Foundation, and they had done extensive work with the patients themselves to see, you know, what these patients were seeking in terms of guidance. And the Anthony Nolan Foundation had developed a pretty extensive working for return to work or working for well-being document that addressed some of these issues that we were hoping to address for our patients.
I'll add that I was thrilled when Dr. Salat approached me about being part of this committee, because as a social worker who worked for many years directly with transplant patients, I saw that returning to work was paramount for many of our patients, and our approach to helping patients was fairly cursory. We talked about it briefly in the pre-transplant assessment. We were very good about addressing requests for paperwork to be completed for FMLA, Family Medical Leave Act, leaves of absence, or disability. However, there weren't a lot of ongoing conversations or attention to this. And so I was grateful that Dr. Salat was going to put some focus on this and really raise it up as an issue that needed to be addressed in the world of transplantation. I think that we too often, because patients who require transplant are very, very sick, we get laser focused on the treatment they need and getting them better and getting rid of their cancer or their disease. And the experience of the patient, of course, they want that. Of course, they want to get better, and they want to live their life. They want to get better so that they can continue the life that brought them joy and happiness and fulfillment. And work is part of that for a lot of people, and it's simply necessary for many, many people to work in order to make enough money to live and support themselves and support their families. So I think this guidance is a great starting point, and it really highlights the fact that we have to be talking about this. We have to be talking about this in our transplant centers and community hemoc offices with our patients. It really matters to them, and they need our help.
And I think some of the focus for the committee was that much of the return to work research has been done in breast cancer patients or other solid tumor. And so that was really you know, what we had to turn to in terms of evidence. And I think that there were some strong feelings from the committee that we really needed to make our guidance specific for transplant patients, that many of the solid tumor patients actually work through their treatment. And we actually, you know, our patients drop out. Many of them have leukemia diagnoses where they're off for a month from the get-go. That the transplant process itself is just very rigorous. They're hospitalized for long periods of time and they're very sick, and rehospitalizations are very common. That there's long-term side effects such as graft versus host disease after transplant that are very different than solid tumor patients who receive a surgery and a chemotherapy and then are done. And so a lot of the workplace policies and you know, the short-term disability type benefits that those patients benefit from aren't really enough for our patients. And so that we needed additional guidance other than, you know, from what was currently recommended in the literature for some of the solid tumor patients, because it was really a different patient population.
The other thing I'll mention, and Dr. Salad, I'm interested what you think about this. I think particularly for healthcare professionals and maybe more specifically for doctors, it can be difficult to bring something up with a patient if that person, that physician, doesn't feel well equipped to address it. So I think sometimes if a doctor really doesn't know the landscape of disability and taking a leave and, you know, employer policies that might affect someone going back to work or getting the accommodations they need, sometimes there's a hesitancy to even bring it up because they don't want to stand in a position where the patient has all sorts of questions and wants to talk about it, and they don't have anything to rely on or any knowledge. And I think this guidance helps fill that gap for physicians and for other medical professionals.
I do agree. I think that physicians don't address return to work sort of for two reasons. One is because there's not really time to sort of open that box. And I agree that we're sort of focused on, okay, we need to, you know, cure this patient's disease. And the focus isn't really how are we going to get this patient back to work. I think now that I have this lens, I realize how eager the patients are to talk about how are they going to get back to work even when I do the initial consult. And so what I've started doing is when I meet with them for the very first time, I talk about, you know, how important is work to their lives? Would they plan on returning? How do they see that? And, you know, starting to even brainstorm then how they can start having conversations with their supervisor and their employers in terms of, you know, what might be expected when they come through the treatment. Just so there is some, you know, appreciation for the employer, from the employer, that the person might want to keep their job, that they're interested in making this work with their employer. And, you know, not to get ahead of ourselves, but I think that, you know, this piece with the employers that the doctors often leave out is, you know, is one of the key elements of the guidance, that we, you know, work in sort of our healthcare realm, and we're doing our thing. And, you know, the patient has this whole outside life. And if we want to try to get them back to their outside life, part of our role in facilitating that is to communicate with their employer or their supervisor to try to translate what realistic expectations are.
I think that's so key for our patients. I think about the fact that many post-transplant patients look like they're okay. Physically, they're often able to walk around, and maybe their, you know, their hair has grown back, and you can't necessarily see manifestations of GVHD physically, and that can be tricky for patients when they're trying to go back to work, and maybe what their boss sees on a day-to-day basis or what their coworkers see is that they seem to be fine and it's been a year. And so I think that communication is really key, because it's hard to help someone understand what might be going on for this person and what might be really difficult, what the risks are in terms of infection, or just the impact of fatigue that our patients deal with post-transplant.
Yeah, and I think there is a little bit of a disconnect in telling people that, you know, you may want to anticipate being out of work for a year in order to get them long-term disability and protected and able to pay for their medications and, you know, not just send them out without a net, and then encouraging them to try to reintegrate, whatever that means. And so I think that, you know, the fine line is being able to not paralyze a patient to the point where they're going to lose their job, or their job won't be held for them. And, you know, having them go back too fast, because there are data that show that if they go back too fast, they might not be successful. And so, and that's, I think, a nuanced thing that, hopefully the transplant center physicians can help community physicians or, you know, employers sort through. One of the items that was suggested to me by Paul Carpenter at our institution, who's now head of our long-term follow-up clinic, was to create a return to work tool that the physicians could complete with the patients, or any provider could complete with the patient. And there's also a section that the employer could complete with the patient. And it was assessing, you know, where is the patient in their journey, and in their mindset, and, you know, cognitively and physically, and then what are the employer expectations and what is the job description look like. I think that, I'm sure, I don't know, Katie, if you were impressed when Jaleel Muhammad drew a picture of what things are like in England, where he practiced at the rehab center, where there's a physical or occupational therapist that actually assesses the patient, then goes to the job site, and then makes some sort of connection between you know, where is the patient and what does the job need, and works with them to make that come together. And so I don't think we right now have that type of resource here in the United States, but one of the aims of the guidance is to sort of get us closer to that, where it's, you know, someone's evaluating and assessing the patient, evaluating, assessing the job site, because the employers don't have an appreciation, as Katie said, of what the patient can do. And if the providers don't ask, they might not know what the patient can do and what to recommend to the employers in terms of creating accommodations for them in order to make them successful.
And on the topic of accommodations, I think that's a place where we have a lack of understanding for what accommodations can be applied to a patient who's returning to work after transplant. Employers are required, when there's a disclosed diagnosis or disability through the Americans with Disabilities Act, to allow for reasonable accommodations so that a patient can return to work. And there are many, many kinds of accommodations. Things like, someone may need to be able to relocate in their office so that they're closer to a bathroom or farther from bright lights that are shining in. It may be that they need to work a split schedule because they have to rest during the day. So they put in 4 hours, they have 4 hours to sleep and take care of themselves and come back 4 hours for work. Maybe it's working from home if that's an option, or coming back half time. There's just so many different accommodations. And I think sometimes patients are hesitant to ask for them. And even providers might think that there aren't options and that the only option is for a patient to go back full time to the job that they did before and then say, you won't be able to do that.
I think that we talked a little bit about what another thing that's sort of interesting, you know, in terms of asking these accommodations is that the patient has to have a job in order to be able to ask for accommodations. And so what I was finding is that we were encouraging them to stay out of work for a year. And when someone's job is held for a year, the employer doesn't have a lot of empathy at that point for providing these types of accommodations. And so often when the patient, you know, is out of work for even 6 or 9 months, they start thinking like, okay, if you're not going to be able to come back full time, we're not going to be able to hold your job for you. And so that's when they start saying, you know, maybe this isn't the best fit. And if you're not going to be able to come back for a year and you're not going to be able to come back full time, then, you know, this isn't going to work out. If the patient starts talking to their employer early on and frequently, so we found we conducted a recent patient survey of 1,000 patients at our center and found that patients who communicate with their employers at least monthly are more likely to be successful returning to work. So I think this communication piece is big. And if they are willing and able to even work, you know, 2 hours a day or 1 to 2 days a week, 3 to 6 months after transplant, then the employers seem much more willing to make all of these accommodations and, you know, believing that maybe with the flexibility, they'll be able to slowly grade up. And there's an appreciation of that effort. And the patients seem to be open to it and actually derive fulfillment by going back and, you know, seeing their colleagues who are friends and, you know, feeling like they're contributing to the workplace again, even if it's just a few hours a week. You know, they feel like they're not a patient when they're there. And so that, you know, that's beneficial to the patient and to the employer and sort of leads to this collaboration where they can really start to make it work towards a long-term goal.
I think Americans spend 33% of their time, their lifetime at work or something like that. That's really significant. This is a huge part of what we do. And I think that highlights why we have to be talking about this. It's a big deal.
Absolutely. I think that it's the points that you're bringing up about communication and collaboration, you know, not just between healthcare providers, but outside of that space into the patient's, you know, external life from the healthcare system and with their employer. It seems like it would be very easy to overlook with the complexities of the transplant process and is kind of a less frequently considered post-transplant quality of life measure, this concept of returning to work. So I'd love to get your thoughts a little bit about the importance of capturing patient-reported outcomes in general, like post-transplant quality of life, and how return to work kind of fits in to that landscape of PROs, as they're commonly called. Like, what did you see in the literature that was currently out there? It sounds like it was a little bit skewed towards solid tumors at this point. But yeah, I would love to hear your thoughts.
Maybe Katie can speak to it better. I don't think that there was any patient reported outcome research in the literature. From what I saw, there's qualitative research. So there's interviews, there's focus groups, you know, there's discussions with patients about, you know, what were barriers in terms of returning to work and what were facilitators, what they would like to see. There's 2 papers, one from the Netherlands and one from Australia, that did this type of qualitative interview research of post-transplant or post blood cancer patient research. And there was one study in Japan that looked at flexible working and how did that facilitate patients returning to work. And they found that giving patients flexibility greatly increased their return to work success. And in our survey, patients reported that having a supportive employer and flexibility in their workplace or schedule greatly facilitated their return to work. But there's one patient return to work self-efficacy patient reported outcome measure that we're hoping to use when we do some prospective work in this area, but we haven't gotten there quite yet.
I'll add that broadly speaking, patient reported outcomes are incredibly important as a measure, and I think we're paying more and more attention to them over time. But the reality is that how patients do and feel and what their quality of life is relevant to the ultimate goal. That's what we want. We want people to live well and do well, not just be alive with a beating heart. So they're incredibly important. And I think, that is the next step for this return to work guidance, is to study how effective is this. If we implement some of these recommendations, if the medical team collaborates around supporting patients and returning to work, can we move the needle on some of these really important PROs? So I think that's where the next steps in our work lie.
I wanted to make a point that occurred to me when we were talking about COVID, because I think that the transplant community felt like COVID was pretty devastating for a lot of reasons to our patients. And I would say, in certain cases, I do think that it may have hampered our patients returning to work. They were scared and the protections weren't there for them. And a lot of them quit or lost their jobs during that time. And it was, I don't want to underscore how devastating it was, but the framework that employers have now about flexible work and some of the things Katie was talking about with split work schedules or, working from home or working at a desk that may be far away from people, and some of these accommodations that they now have made routinely are being applied to our patients. So they're seeing sort of a secondary benefit from employers being forced to address these issues during the COVID era. And so things that were previously thought as hampering quality of work, like working from home or taking time off in the middle of the day for whatever reason, whether during COVID it was childcare or it's doctor's appointments, is now being seen as acceptable, that people are able to work on their own time, in their own place, on their own schedule, and still work very effectively. And so I think that's going to carry over. And so it's a really good time to start doing this type of work with employers, because it's much more accepted than it was 3 years ago to be making these requests.
I agree. And the other way that the shifts that happen due to COVID help are that patients are more likely to be able to have certain appointments virtually. So they might see their therapist or even APP in the survivorship clinic via virtual appointment. And that means a lot less time away from work for travel to and from the clinic.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. That is true.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense and is a really interesting way in which the pandemic may be helping to actually alleviate some of the barriers for return to work for these post-transplant patients. But Dr. Salat, I know you brought up some of the research that currently exists that you found on major barriers faced returning to work. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about those and how the recommendations that you put forth as a committee are sort of targeted to help overcome those barriers.
I mean, I think that one of the major barriers for patients is physical strength and fatigue. That was one of the, you know, one of the things we most commonly see in long-term patients. We did put forth in the recommendations to sort of dispel this myth that patients with low blood counts can't have physical therapy, and recommended doing physical therapy starting before the transplant, but also through that initial engraftment period, and then continuing that physical therapy. A lot of patients in our survey actually asked for that as well. Like, they felt that they needed more physical therapy in order to keep up their strength to be able to return to their jobs after working. I think things like, you know, post-traumatic stress and depression and anxiety are big things, you know, that make it difficult for people to return to work. And we provided some referrals for, psychological evaluations and vocational rehab evaluations. You know, there's sometimes a disparity between, as Katie pointed out at the beginning, what the doctor thinks or what the employer thinks the patient's ready for and what the patient thinks they're ready for. And some of those measures can get at where the patient actually is and what they're capable of. Other barriers are just things like, you know, they can't work a full day straight, or they need time to get to doctor's appointments. Or they were hospitalized, and, you know, some of the recommendations include, you know, this, you know, return to work tool where they ask for what they need, and it, and hopefully will empower both the patient to ask for what they need because they know, oh, this is what is possible, and also for the providers to facilitate to the employers, this is what the patient needs. So they can return to work, but they need X amount of time for sick time allowed. They need to have an hour during the day to be able to regroup because it's hard to focus for long periods of time. And so it just sort of addressed some of these common issues that we see with our patients that don't necessarily prevent them from working, but maybe... you know, require some adjustment to be able to help them work effectively at their previous job. I think we did talk about a little bit in our prior conversation, Katie and I did, that, you know, that a lot of these accommodations that are talked about in the ADA and, you know, that I'd previously talked about with COVID address specifically sort of white collar workers, people who work in offices. You know, we talk a lot about working from home. You know, we talk about ability to focus on a computer is sort of our standard language. But there's many patients that are labor workers, retail workers, farmers, you know, things where, you know, we do advise, oh, you shouldn't be digging in dirt if you're on immune suppression, or you shouldn't be near sick people if you're on immune suppression. And, you know, some of these dogma type things, you know, are not necessarily based on research. And I'm not saying that these patients who are, you know, the questions I've gotten the most are from farmers and house cleaners and, you know, medical assistants and preschool teachers. And they're all wondering, you know, I'm not vaccinated. I worry I'm going to get sick, and, you know, I'm worried about touching chemicals, and, you know, all of those things are real worries. And I don't want to, you know, go out there or be quoted on saying, oh, it's just safe, go back. But I do think that the risks and benefits must be weighed. I was telling Katie about a case of a medical assistant that I worked with who was going to not be able to afford to pay for her mortgage and her, you know, raise her kids if she was not working. The disability benefits are just not high enough to afford a mortgage and raise a family. And so we worked with her employer to make sure that she was able to use safe practices and not see certain types of patients in the medical facility. And they found a way to accommodate her so she could go back to work 3 months after transplant. So I think some of this absolute language that we've been using really doesn't support workers that need to be out in the whatever field they're in. And that those people often do need to work even more to be able to make an income, support their families, you know, make ends meet. And with those employers, we need to even advocate more in order to make these types of accommodations. And the employers that work in those industries are often used to making accommodations for workers' compensation. And so workers' compensation provides extensive accommodations for patients that are injured. And the employers who work, you know, for patients who do more physical work, you know, are able to create accommodations if they know what accommodations are needed. And so I think, you know, a big take home point is we just need to be more proactive about letting these employers know that this person can go back to work, but in order to safely go back, they may need to make a few allowances.
Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for the second half of this episode, where our guests discuss coordinated care and overcoming patient barriers for returning to work after transplant.